Hey everybody, coming up on today's show, we've got a brief look back on history, and we're going to talk about how things are transforming around the world in four main categories: cost of capital, energy, labor, and transportation, and what the New World Order, no, not the conspiracy type of New World Order, but the New World Order around economics, manufacturing, business, and what that means to your portfolio and future going forward. Stay tuned and you will learn more.
It's time to make the dough rise, the financial podcast with Brian Doe.
It's time to make the dough rise. I'm Walter Osterholt alongside Brian Doe, certified financial planner at Livingworth Wealth Advisors, serving you in the Lake Country and beyond, based out of Greensboro, Georgia. But you can listen to us from anywhere on your favorite podcasting apps. Great to have you back with us for another episode. And Brian, I'm looking forward to our chat today. And I hope life has been treating you well these last couple of weeks, my friend.
Yeah, no, I think we've got a good topic today, and life has been treating me very well. I was able to take the girls up to North Carolina and did a little ski trip over winter break. So that was a fun little adventure.
No broken legs or trees run into or anything like that?
No broken legs. We had two boyfriends that went along with us. So I actually had five ski students. My girls had skied once. The boys had not skied ever. So I had to get out there and get everybody geared up and teach them how to ski and all this kind of stuff. And my daughter, Hannah, had... In her attempt to help, had asked somebody, hey, which one of these lifts is for the bunny hill? Guy sort of pointed in a general direction, and there were actually two lifts there. And so she assumed he was pointing at one, and he was actually pointing at the other. So I believed her, and we all hopped on the lift that she said to get on. And that's the one that took you to the Black Diamonds and the Blue Intermediate Hills.
Right.
So I had five people up there that didn't know how to ski, and we literally had like... fall down the hill to get just back to the segment of the bunny hill.
Scoot it on down.
Yep.
Which mountain is this, by the way?
Beach Mountain and Sugar.
Yeah, Beach and Sugar, right?
Yeah. In fact, Sugar was probably my favorite. I think the conditions there were a lot better and a lot better runs. And yeah, it was a little warm, so the snow was a little bit slushy at times. But we had a really big snowstorm the third day, and my girls had never experienced that. Obviously, growing up in Minnesota, I had experienced a lot of those, but it was fun for them to see the big snowflakes and have it piling up on us as we rode up the lift, and that was new for them.
No doubt about it. That is great. I got decent at snowboarding last season, but I got a little too confident at the end and was like, I'm going to start doing some of these moguls. Let's see what these are all about. And oh my gosh, it took me like half an hour to get off of that run, and I was like, I felt like I'd been through a washing machine at that point. That was very brutal. So I know that feeling of getting trapped up at the top of a run that you're not so sure you're going to make it down from. So
we had a few terrified white knuckle moments, but we got everybody going. We had a good time. Everybody really enjoyed it.
So much fun. Well, glad to hear that the trip went well. And yeah, it's always fun. You come back with great stories from those kinds of trips. Well, you teased us very nicely to start off the show today, Brian, with what's on the docket today. Seems like you're getting lots of comments and questions and pondering from people about a recession. This has been something that's been certainly popping up in and out of the news over the last couple of years at this point, and sometimes more heavily than others. And you're kind of like, all right, this is going to change how we focus. And where we shift our attention a little bit. If the recession happened, obviously, that would have been something that would have been, you know, really changing drastically, I think, our financial outlook. And now that it seems that maybe the recession kind of has not come to fruition and we're heading in a new, different direction, maybe breaking out of those doldrums, it's time to start thinking about things a little bit differently. So I like how you set the stage for all of that, and interesting to see where you want to take things today.
Yeah, everybody's been talking about recession for a couple of years, you know, 2 or 3 years now. We had a mini one during COVID. We had the two quarters of contraction a couple years ago. They didn't quite want to call it a recession for political reasons and because the unemployment numbers didn't match up with what they wanted to make the definition of a recession. So what we're seeing internationally, and this is going to tie into what we're going to talk about later. So what we're seeing internationally is recessions in a lot of countries. You know, most of the European countries, Japan, China, they're all having issues and contracting economies and things like that. There's a very good reason why that is, and also why that's not what I see happening in the U.S. And I will share with you real briefly, the Capital Group put out a really nice piece that outlined what happened in the U.S., and they're arguing that we basically had a rolling recession or several subsector mini recessions over the last couple of years, that if you concentrated all of them into one time period, it would have been a more major recession. But you had a COVID-induced travel recession that timed differently from a manufacturing recession. Oil had a bit of a roller coaster ride. Chemicals, housing, semiconductors, and banking, like we saw with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic and some of those, and maybe even some of those issues flaring up again right now. All of those things put together happened at different cycles. And so we've had a bit of a stagnation in each of these sectors, but they didn't overlap. They didn't all occur at the same time. And now we're starting to see a big manufacturing resurgence. We've got a strong economy, unemployment's remaining low. So I think it's entirely possible we may move right past this. I made a joke several years ago in front of a group of financial planners, certified financial planners, about, well, we were going to have this perfect soft landing and the market was going to do great. And everybody laughed and chuckled like it was a huge joke. But yeah, it's kind of looking like that may well be the case. And I'm not advocating for major portfolio changes based on a short-term recession. Never have, never will. I don't think that's the way to go. But I have been pulling away from international markets for, again, all the reasons that we're about to talk about.
Okay, very good. I like this idea that this shift in focus needs to happen. And it's interesting that you're noticing it not just in, you know, hey, there's this one little area that we need to kind of focus on these changes, but you're seeing kind of some bigger sea changes in lots of different sectors.
So I talked about the New World Order. I think we titled the podcast, yeah, The New, right, World Order. And everybody likes to go back and play that clip of George Bush, you know, talking about the New World Order as some big conspiracy theory or something like that. But what George Bush Sr. Actually meant by that was, we were in a global arrangement post-World War II, and a lot of this goes back to the commentary and predictions of Peter Zeihan that I have talked about multiple times on previous podcasts. So I'll just do a quick recap. And basically, it was after World War II, most global economies were decimated. The United States was the one, you know, industrial power that was, you know, still intact from an infrastructure standpoint. And we had one objective, and that was getting everyone to side with us against the Soviet Union. We still saw the Soviet Union as a major threat. And so we went to all the European countries, ultimately China in the 70s when Nixon went there. The deal was, side with us against Russia, and we will open up our markets for you. We don't want to come occupy or take over. We helped win the war. We were actually in a position, if we were these great colonists, we could have taken over so many countries, but we didn't want to do that. We were still putting out electrical grid in Western Kansas. I mean, we had plenty of opportunity here in the U.S. We did not need to try and take over all these other countries. So what we said is, we will police the global oceans and make transportation and global commerce possible, as long as everybody quits warring with each other and sides with us against Russia should that, you know, become an issue. And that lasted, you know, as the basic reigning world order. We talked about the Bretton Woods Accords, and that's where that all came from. Well, newsflash, the Soviet Union collapsed back in 1991, Walter. Were you familiar with that?
I was still a young lad at that time.
Yeah, well, and I was graduating college, and that was the big thing. But yeah, that order, if you look at NATO and the globalization of trade and the ability to outsource jobs and access resources from all different countries, global maritime transportation is what's made that possible. Well, what we have seen since George Bush made that proclamation about creating a new world order, and arguably he was the best educated, equipped, and had the understanding of how to reshape this global order. And instead of reelecting him, we voted Bill Clinton in because he was a good-looking guy that could play the saxophone. And ever since then, we've had more and more, I guess you would call it U.S.-centric, less global-centric administrations. And so much of even what we're seeing with Trump and Make America Great Again, that's all resonating with people because we have depleted manufacturing jobs in this country. We have outsourced a lot of things. There's been a lot of good that's come from it, but there's been a lot of people that are also suffering under that, that we're not seeing a lot of political leadership on this. And you've seen this play out in interesting ways with like Trump. If you go back and play the tapes of him talking to NATO members about paying their share of NATO and the U.S. pays this amount and everybody needs to pay more. I think these foreign countries are looking at us like, I'm pretty sure you don't understand the arrangement. The arrangement was is you all were going to cover that mostly, and we were going to side with you against Russia. And that has changed dramatically as far as sentiment in the U.S., understanding of this, and the fact that the Soviet Union collapsed back in 91, is that still the threat that it used to be? But this global commerce system that was set up has remained intact, and it's starting to come apart. And I'll talk about that when we get to the subcategories here, but that's basically the big shift. Is everything's coming back to the U.S., this hemisphere, U.S., Mexico, Canada, and it will be a very interesting, somewhat tumultuous forecast for the rest of the world in the years ahead.
We're always afraid of change, and we're in really feels like a season of constant and dramatic change, both on this global and domestic scale. And that's not even talking about just the political side of things. I mean, things just move so quickly today with technology advancements and always just new products, new investments to look into. So yeah, you got to kind of keep your head on a swivel. And I feel like that change causes a lot of fear in people and can make it just really hard to make decisions in this kind of environment. So I'm glad that we're going to get to zero in on some of these subcategories, if you will. And you mentioned them, cost of capital, energy, labor, and transportation are what we're going to break down one by one here. You want to dive into these, Brian? What's the first one you want to go after?
Yeah, well, at first, I think you make a very good point. The speed of communication has been amplified with the internet technology. We're so quickly jumping from Ukraine to what's happening to Israel to what's happening. I mean, it's just boom, boom, boom. There's one issue after the other. And I don't think people really back up and look at how these things are all connected and what the impact of that is. So, yeah, we'll dive into that. And I'll start with cost of capital. We enjoyed a period of near zero cost of borrowing for better part of the last decade. Now that has ended and we've seen inflation spike and maybe it was due to COVID, maybe it was due to Fed monetary policy, whatever it is. But Peter Zeihan would argue that it's a demographic phenomenon as well. And I don't think it's any one of these. I think it's actually a combination of them. But you have the boomers are retiring. About half the boomers have retired. And that represented the largest demographic group and the largest personal savings where they'd had their capital invested in the markets and there was an abundance of cheap capital looking for opportunities that fueled the tech boom, that fueled some of the energy exploration that happened in the U.S. Well, half of the boomers have retired and a lot of people that don't have excess capital in that situation get more conservative. So they take their money out of markets, out of more speculative investments, and hey, now you can get a good yield in money markets. So maybe I'm going to move some money over to this safe, treasuries and high quality bonds and money market to fuel my retirement. And we've got another 7 to 10 years to go before the rest of the boomers retire, but that trend is happening, is underway, and is going to continue. And we won't see that capital buildup recur until the millennials reach their 50s and 60s, much like the boomers. There's actually a demographic dip with Gen X. And so we're going to see a shortage of cheap capital. And that is at a time when we are aggressively trying to rebuild the industrial plant and infrastructure in this hemisphere. We've seen a dramatic increase in spending domestically. And much like the time after World War II, when we went from, they called it from guns to butter, and we were all geared up for military production, wartime production, and then all the soldiers came home, we had lots of babies, we had the baby boom get started, we had to rebuild here in the U.S. And so we experienced inflation for about 4 or 5 years after World War II due to that shift that is not unlike the shift that's happening today here in the U.S. So cost of capital is going to be a big one. If you can't borrow cheap, you're going to have to find other sources, or there's going to be less capital for new and speculative investments.
Yeah, we've seen that just on the small scale with people not being able to kind of buy the house that they want and from the mortgage perspective, just because money's not cheap anymore. Mm-hmm. And people, when you get used to that, it's a little hard to get off of that train. You know, that's going to probably have some lag time for people to get used to that on an individual basis, Brian. And I would imagine it's the same thing at the larger scales with corporations and governments and that kind of thing, too.
Yeah, they're talking about interest rates being at 20, 25-year highs. And I'm like, oh, these were the rates. These rates are actually lower than what my first home was financed at. So,
right. It's not the end of the world, but still hard to get used to.
Exactly.
Yeah. At least for the younger generations, perhaps. Okay. So cost of capital, that's one of the major issues and sea changes. That one's easy enough to track. What else would you want to tackle next?
Well, energy is the big one. Obviously, the cost of energy inputs, that fuels everything. No pun intended there, but it
that was a good pun. I like that.
If your cost of energy, or if we have, I think what's going to happen is the green dream is about to hit a wall of reality with the fact that some of those technologies don't scale up, or they don't work geographically where you need them to, or you have to go dig up half the other planet to get the minerals and metals that are needed to make wind and solar and those things a true reality. And we are actually sitting on and have a reserve of oil and gas in this country due to the shale revolution and fracking. We've heard about so much about that over the last 10, 15 years. We've actually got the capability to be energy independent in this country and have it at a fraction of the price of what it's going to cost other countries around, especially China. China has a big issue with getting oil to them geographically, because most of it has to go, travel so far by sea. We've got it right under our feet here. And so you're going to see major opportunities for low cost energy if we can get behind building the actual infrastructure that we need. And that's going to be things like pipelines and railroads and stuff like that. Interesting fact or statistic here to make this real, or thought it was informative. In 1990, 80% of global energy came from fossil fuels. Okay. We've had this big alternative energy push, for the last, 20, 30 years. What percent of current global energy do you think is still coming from fossil fuels?
Only because I can see the answer on our notes, Brian. But I would definitely not have guessed that it's increased. Wow.
It's actually 82% today.
Yeah.
So all of the initiatives for clean energy has caused a 2% increase in total energy, global energy output from fossil fuels. So the idea that those are going away, or that we're not going to be able to, or that we're going to make this huge transition, I just don't see it happening. People need to embrace the fact that natural gas burns far cleaner than coal, burns cleaner than oil, and or nuclear, and some of the new nuclear technology that we have. If we can't embrace these new technologies, then that's going to impede our transition into the new world order that I'm talking about.
Speaking of this, the New World Order and energy, I feel like we just recently, just this week, there was the big, that study that came out that kind of turned some heads about the electric vehicles releasing more toxic emissions than gas-powered vehicles. And now the EPA says they're looking into that study to study the study some more and figure all that out. And it's another ding, I think, a little bit against just that green wall of reality, I think, that you've kind of described it as before, and it's hitting it hard right now.
Yeah, and instead of needing to dig up steel and oil, they're having to dig up cobalt and lithium and molybdenum and all those other chemicals and minerals that I can't pronounce.
Right.
And it's going to require, you know, more countries and more mining, and I don't think they've quite factored that into the equation.
Yeah, and even the cars themselves now apparently are releasing more microplastics into the environment than other things. Just another thing to add to the list. To me, it's just why it makes total sense to let the market figure all of this out and keep a diversity of energy resources. A little bit of oil, a little bit of natural gas. Hey, yeah, we can do the battery thing. Let's try it all. A little bit of solar, a little bit of this. Let's see what really works over time. Let's let it test all out over the course of a century.
The top two rules of new venture investing are, is it better and is it cheaper? And if it's better and it's cheaper, it will be adopted. Yeah. You're not going to have to force it, push it, subsidize it. And we're just not seeing that with the green stuff yet.
Yeah, definitely an issue there. So energy, big one. That one's definitely not going to change in terms of things that are swiftly happening and being in the news all the time. So glad that we are keeping our eyes on that one. So cost of capital, energy, we've knocked those two down. You want to talk labor next?
Yeah, so labor is going to be another big input cost. Obviously, we've got a lot of demographic shifts here in the U.S. You know, we talked about the baby boom, the Gen X, the millennials, and then the, you know, going to be the, I guess the echo boom, and then we're going to have the echo bust with the Gen Z numbers. So we've got a little bit of a roller coaster demographically here in the U.S. Well, we've got all of these baby boomers retiring, and they're retiring with their skill sets. And so we're going to lose that skill set, and there's going to be a shortage of workers and employees. And it's going to take some time to get the next generation skill set and numbers into the workforce. I think one of the big reasons we're seeing this open borders, immigration, you know, push, I don't like how it's being done, but immigration will be what will fuel the labor demand and shortage that we could have here in the U.S. And I think it's being done more for political reasons. But if we're going to have a manufacturing return to this hemisphere, we're going to need skilled and semi-skilled workers to fuel that. And interestingly, right now, Mexico has a better skilled and lower cost workforce than China. And this all these things all overlap and intersect. China's having a massive demographic collapse. Germany, Italy, we've talked about several of these. And if they don't have the bodies, their skill set is retiring, the capital is drying up, and the labor is going along with it just because we don't have the quantity of people. So if we have a training programs, things to bring skill levels up, companies are going to have to invest in their workers more. And so much of the, you know, college education is more abstract type thinking, as opposed to hard skills and trades and things like that. So we're going to have to see what shapes up and what companies, or if we can get, again, any kind of policy behind this, that's going to help fuel the transition. But labor costs and labor inputs are going to be more expensive moving ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at that labor demographic, and I feel like you hear all sorts of different viewpoints of I can't find anybody that wants to work, to people wanting to work and can't seem to, you know, ever get an interview. And it's like, how can these two things be so incongruent?
Yeah, it that is bizarre to me. But and then the other one is AI is going to take over all of our jobs and there's not going to be any work for anybody to do. So I don't know.
Yeah. I've worked a little with AI. It still needs some work. We're still a little ways away from it replacing everybody, I think.
I was watching an interesting video. I think it was on YouTube. We were talking about YouTube earlier. This electrician installing, you know, like heavy industrial level electrical work. I'm sorry, AI is not going to be able to go and run a wire and set up an electrical panel for you unless you've got some kind of robot that can do that. Yeah, maybe that's the answer. Well, but yeah, you're still going to need people with some skills, and stuff's going to have to get made, assembled, put together, and transported. So
Yeah, the dancing robots and the ones that can jump up onto boxes and do some backflips and things like that. I mean, they're getting pretty cool and pretty advanced, but there's still some very fine motor skills things that I think they're going to have to spend a few more years dialing in. So
yeah, we'll see what
those
happens.
Bridges when we get there. Yeah, exactly. All right, transportation, our last big one here.
So obviously, transportation by water is the cheapest way to go. And the reason the U.S. is such a capital-creating machine is because we have these amazing river systems that connect to these oceans on the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. You literally have cities like Chicago and Minneapolis and St. Louis, all these very inland capital centers that are very near waterways that have access to the oceans. And so the ability to move product at a massive scale for cheap is a function of how much water you have access to transport things by. And so that's one of the huge, huge competitive advantages that the United States has. And then if you compare that, so if you take that globally, so much of the globalization and global commerce has been driven by cheap global transportation. Well, look what is starting to happen. If the U.S., go back to my original premise, if the U.S. is pulling back and not policing the global oceans as much, and if we don't have the economic incentive to do so, we don't need to be mucking around as much in the Middle East because we don't need the cheap, reliable energy. We've got it ourselves. Well, look what's happening in the Red Sea. The Houthis are shelling and bombing or targeting ships coming through the Red Sea, and it's disrupting the total global flow of transportation. So now ships and companies are taking their transport all the way around Africa, the southern tip of Africa, to avoid being attacked and shot down by this, arguably relatively small, I don't know if you'd call it a militia or a rebel group or whatever it is. But these types of things are what Peter Zeihan predicted. If you don't have a force like the U.S. bringing in the aircraft carrier, shutting them down, much like Reagan did in the Persian Gulf back in the 80s, when there was some uprising or similar type event there, if the U.S. is not going to stamp that down, then it's going to change the literal cost and time to transport because you have to reroute around the old, ancient routes of the 17, 1800s before you had these canals and passages that dramatically cut the cost and distance of transportation. So you're seeing things like that. And you can even argue that China has a vested interest now in what's happening there because they're so dependent on energy getting through, through those waterways. They even sent a few warships into the Red Sea. I don't know if that made big headlines, but I did see something about that. They weren't super carriers. They weren't the kind of force projection that the U.S. has, but they were still sending ships there to help with the transport that they need to get the energy that they need and to get their products to the West. We're seeing this in Ukraine. Obviously, Ukraine has lost transport by water with the Russian invasion. And so all of the Ukrainian agricultural products, they're now being shipped by rail through Poland and disrupting markets over there and consuming the rail capacity that Poland had access to for their products. And so you're seeing protests where the Polish farmers are dumping, rail cars full of grain from Ukraine in protest. So when these, geopolitical or war type things flare up, it's creating major disruptions to the transportation chains. And without a big force like the U.S. in there to say, nope, we're going back to normal. We're gonna, we're not gonna fight, and everybody is gonna have free access to the waterways. Already, we're seeing two big ones with the Middle East and Ukraine. The other one that's interesting to observe, and if you want to chalk one up for climate change, or maybe this is a temporary thing, we're seeing the Panama Canal is losing capacity. The big lake that fuels the water that they need to make the Panama Canal work has not been getting the rainfall that they need. And so again, we're having to reroute all the way around South America. So what's the answer to that? What's the solution? It's not cheap. If they're going to do some kind of permanent fix, that you're going to redig the Panama Canal. I don't know. That would be a major undertaking. And so those are some interesting things that are actually playing out. A lot of the stuff that Peter Zeihan had predicted, and then you're actually seeing in North Dakota all the energy that's being produced there. Well, that's one of the states that has the least access to the domestic waterways. And so they're more reliant on railroad transportation. Well, all the agricultural products from North Dakota were going by rail, but now they're competing with the energy producers, the oil and gas producers, for rail access. So it's all of this transportation infrastructure, getting stuff where it needs to be at the lowest possible cost, a lot of disruptors there, a lot of factors. And again, all of these are a disfavor or cost more to international companies. And I would say the potential and the future benefit of this is going to go to domestic companies.
Mm. Wow. I got to tell you, Brian, I am, as just sort of a lay person, I feel like I might be like a lot of our listeners. It's overwhelming, like trying to just wrap your brain around these macro things. I mean, it's just... I mean, your details there on the transportation conversation are just wild to think about all of those moving parts and the benefits, the negatives, and the changes happening to it all before we even get to the labor, energy, and cost of capital sections that you talked about earlier. I mean, it's hard to kind of just stay afloat and understand all of this, even at a small amount, and really feel like we know what's going on in this grand scheme. I mean, that just, I don't know, kind of makes you feel small in both a good and bad way, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's very overwhelming. But if I can sum it up for you, the opportunity lies in the companies, the entrepreneurs, and the visionaries that can take these obstacles and transform them into the solutions to these actual problems. These are real problems. Like these aren't going away. These aren't going to just magically disappear and we're going back to 2019. Like 2019 pre-COVID was probably the zenith of, you know, what was that, the end of that old world order that we'd had since World War II. And now we're retooling. And just to put a number around it, we saw domestic U.S. manufacturing spending. Let's just look at that one number. From 2020, it was like $70 billion in 2020. By 2023, that had almost tripled to $209 billion. Well, let's look at what happened. The need to diversify their supply chains, less reliance on China, you know, keep things in this hemisphere. And we had good political leadership. We had the CHIPS Act and we had the infrastructure bill. Now, I don't know how much of the infrastructure bill is being properly spent, but these numbers are going to result in some improvement to overall infrastructure, rebuilding of the capital, rebuilding of the industrial plant. And if we can get good energy policy and quit villainizing natural gas and recognize that as a cleaner, better solution than some of the dirtier sources, coal specifically, that are still very popular around the world, there's great opportunities here. And there are going to be a number of small companies and innovative companies that are going to take advantage of this. And and I think you're seeing a lot of the big energy companies are acquiring the fracking and shale companies that have made all these discoveries. And so a lot of this is going to get rolled up and scaled up. So solutions are coming, but this is not going to happen in a couple quarters or a couple years. This is going to happen over years, if not decades. So start thinking about those things in those terms, and all of a sudden it's not as ominous as it may sound in the short term, but you have to be looking for the companies that can innovate the solutions, and then you have to have hopefully some political policy that enables them to take advantage of these opportunities.
Very good perspective there. And I think it also, you're right, to look at this in a little bit different light. Yes, we are looking at it as all these problems. How are we going to fix all of this? But keeping in mind that there are individual people and individual companies in each of these areas working on solutions, working on fixing it. And all of that collectively is going to help, you know, make this a less overwhelming task to figure out, find paths forward, and have a little bit more positive outlook here than I think tends to get portrayed, obviously, in the media.
Yeah, I think if I had to bottom line it, I think this is going to be great for the U.S., Canada, Mexico, some South American countries, those that align with us. Japan is a good example. They've had they were the first to have the demographic collapse, and what they have done is they've worked very closely with the U.S. and have helped maneuver around some of the trade and tariff issues that we had. They were popularized with, you know, against China, especially under Trump. They said, "Hey, why don't we come build our plants or put up our plants and build our vehicles in your country?" And so they have actually been able to maneuver around their labor shortage by moving their plants to the countries of demand. They hire local workers. They avoid the tariffs. The products are manufactured where they need to be sold. And Japan's actually been the most innovative in coming up with solutions. So I think a lot of companies will look to Japanese companies for the type of solutions that are actually going to work. So that may be our leader, because they've had the most time to think about this problem already.
All right, very good. I know this may bring up questions for folks listening to today's show, and if that is the case for you, definitely invite you to get in touch, contact us, and ask any questions that you might have to Brian about your financial situation. Where does it fit in the grand scheme as you're trying to understand maybe these macro pieces, or how can you blur out some of that noise and just really focus on your particular plan and your path forward? So if you're looking to take control of your financial future, you're not sure where to start, Brian Doe, again, certified financial planner with more than 20 years of experience, can be that trusted partner. Go to livingworth.com and click book a call to schedule your time to visit, or you can call 706-451-9800. If you're not familiar with certified financial planners, you should know that those professionals meet the highest standards of training, ethics, and always put their clients' best interests first. And you can get a 15-minute complimentary call with Brian, a CFP, to gain clarity on your financial goals and prepare for that more secure tomorrow. So again, go to livingworth.com and click book a call, and we'll have a link to that in the description of today's show as well, so you can find it very easily. Brian, thanks for the great breakdown today. Really felt like I walked away with a couple of items that I've learned, some new tidbits here, and things to be keeping my eye on in the months. And like you said, not years ahead, but I guess decades ahead.
Decades,
right?
Truly.
The new world order.
That's right. Well, yeah, let's hope it's a good one, and I think we'll have good solutions that come out of this. But it's just good to be mindful, not trying to scare anybody. The wheels aren't coming off the bus by any means, but it'll be an interesting time, and those who can position themselves properly will benefit from it.
Might be a flat tire or two along the way, but we can always pull over and change those, right?
There you go. There you go.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Brian. We appreciate it. Thank you for listening to today's show. Come back and join us for the next edition of Make the Dough Rise. Until then, take care.
Make the Dough Rise is brought to you by Living Worth Wealth Advisors, with a central office in Greensboro, Georgia, but serving the Lake Country and beyond. The podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all your favorite podcasting apps. Subscribe today and never miss an episode. Just search for Make the Dough Rise with Brian Doe. You can also visit MakeTheDoughRise.com to listen to recent episodes. If you'd like to contact the show or schedule a complimentary financial review with Brian and the team, just go to MakeTheDoughRise.com and get in touch through the website. Or call 706-451-9800. Thanks for listening to Make the Dough Rise.
Investment advisory services offered through Main Street Financial Solutions, LLC. Information provided is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment, tax, or legal advice. Information is obtained from sources that are deemed to be reliable, but their accurateness and completeness cannot be guaranteed.